Israeli forces arrest a prominent Palestinian activist at a center of a movement to publicize the regime's eviction order in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. A senior Hamas leader says that the group only displayed half of its strength during the recent fighting with Israel, warning that any future war could reshape the region. At least 11 civilians, including four women and three children, are killed in a bomb explosion in western Afghanistan. Good to have you with us. Israeli police have arrested two Palestinian activists in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in the occupied East Jerusalem Al-Quds. Police initially arrested Mona Al-Kurd and took her to a police station for questioning. Her twin brother, Mohammed Al-Kurd, was also arrested hours later. The two activists are at the center of a movement to publicize Tel Aviv's eviction of several Palestinian families from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Palestinians are facing eviction in nearby Silwan District, too. An Israeli rights group says that a move will affect nearly 1,000 Palestinians in both areas. The planned eviction in Sheikh Jarrah has ignited tensions with Palestinians over the past several weeks. Mona Kendall says that the Israeli arrest of the two activists aims to terrorize the Palestinians as they continue to oppose the planned eviction in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood.
Up to the moment, it's not clear what are the charges against Mohammed Al-Kurd and her twin and his twin brother Mona Al-Kurd, but it's very clear, according to experts, that they want to terrorize their parents. They know that Mohammed and Mona, as well as other Palestinian youths from the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, have been working to defend the Palestinians and to stop the forced expulsions from Sheikh Jarrah.
A senior leader of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says that the group only displayed half of its strength during the recent fighting with the Tel Aviv regime.
We showed only half our strength. We managed to launch 130 rockets on Tel Aviv in one barrage, and we only launched our old rockets in the last campaign.
Yahya Sinwar reiterated that the Palestinian resistance emerged victorious in last month's fighting. He warned that any future war with Israel could reshape the region. Palestinian resistance groups dealt severe blows to Israel during the regime's 11-day aggression by firing 4,300 rockets. Israeli media says that a massive rocket fire pushed Tel Aviv to beg the U.S. to mediate a ceasefire. Meantime, the Gaza Health Ministry says 253 Palestinians lost their lives in the Israeli offensive, including 66 children, and some 2,000 others were wounded. Israel's internal spy agency has warned of violence amid political infighting after Prime Minister Netanyahu launched a series of online attacks on his political opponents. In an extraordinary statement, Shin Bet's head, Nadav Argaman, said that the agency has identified a serious rise in violent and inciting discourse on social media. He said that those include references to treason by the now increasingly likely coalition of Netanyahu's opponents. Argaman warned that this could spark violence against members of the coalition. Parties from right, center, and left have announced a power-sharing deal to unseat Netanyahu. He has blasted the new coalition, saying that it endangers Israel and its security. Nearly a dozen civilians, including four women and three children, have been killed in a landmine blast in western Afghanistan. The incident happened at the early morning in the village of Upper Kamara district in Baghdad province. Local officials say that the blast ripped through a vehicle carrying passengers to the city of Kalanao. The district governor has blamed the Taliban for the bombing. The militant group has not commented on the incident. The attack occurred hours before a meeting between the Taliban delegation and UN officials in Qatar as part of the peace process. Afghanistan has seen a rise in deadly violence recently. According to the UN, Some 1,800 civilians were killed or injured during fighting between government forces and the Taliban in the first 3 months of this year. A major U.S. military base in the western Iraqi province of Anbar has been targeted by drones, the second such attack on the facility in more than a month. According to the Iraqi army, two drones were used in the attack on Ain al-Asad Air Base. The UAVs were shut down by U.S. military air defense system. Hours earlier, a rocket was also shut down above a U.S. base at Baghdad Airport. American bases in Iraq have come under increasing rocket and drone attacks amid rising tensions over continued U.S. military presence in the Arab country. Anti-U.S. sentiments escalated following the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Soleimani and Iraqi Commander al-Mohandas in January 2020. Political activist Saad al-Mutallabi says that the U.S. policies in Iraq have not changed since Biden came to office.
It's obvious that the American policy in Iraq hasn't changed with the arrival of Mr. Biden, where we expected a reduction in American forces in Iraq, but contrary to that, we see that the American forces are strengthening their presence, and there are certain effects taking place that are harmful for the nation of Iraq and the security of Iraq, like the exodus or they brought 500 of ISIS families who are saturated with the ISIS way of thought, brought those families back into Iraq. And this is a problem in itself, and the government thinks, or we think that the government is trying to justify that by American pressure on them. This definitely leads to an environment that Iraq may return to violence. So obviously their resistance is using whatever they have means available for them to make a point to the Americans that you need to re-evaluate your position in Iraq, you need to re-evaluate the policy you are taking in Iraq, and Iraq will not be part of the countries that are going to sign a peace treaty with Israel.
Iraq has called for the withdrawal of Turkish forces from its soil. Iraq's presidential office said that the Turkish presence in the country violates good neighborliness and is against international conventions. The office has stressed the need for respecting Iraqi sovereignty. It released a statement the day after militants from Turkey's Kurdistan Workers' Party attacked Kurdish Peshmerga forces in Iraq's Duhok province. Five Peshmerga members were killed. The Iraqi presidential office has condemned the attack. It says the presence of Turkey's PKK militants in Iraq is illegal. Turkey has set up a number of bases on Iraqi soil, saying it uses them to confront PKK militants. Ankara considers PKK a terrorist group. The Yemeni army says it has performed a fresh retaliatory drone strike, successfully hitting targets in Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Saria says that the strike hit King Khalid Air Base near the city of Khamis Mashhad. The Qasif-2K drone was used in the operation in response to the Saudi aggression and continued siege of Yemen. Riyadh and its allies launched a deadly war on the country in March 2015 in order to reinstate a friendly regime. The kingdom's war has left tens of thousands of Yemenis dead, many of them women and children. The United States has blamed Yemen's Ansar movement for the ongoing problems in the Arab country. Those problems include famine, as well as large civilian casualties and shortages of medicines, all resulted by the years-long Saudi war and blockade of Yemen. Saudi Arabia began the war 6 years ago. Since then, it has received logistics support and weapons from a number of countries, including the United States.
Yemen, the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations. The UN says 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian aid, including 10 million suffering from famine. Yemen has struggled with mass outbreaks of infectious diseases, and poverty has surged to affect as much as 78% of the population since 2015, when Saudi Arabia and its regional states launched a devastating war on Yemen. The U.S. and several other Western countries have participated in the war by providing arms and logistic support for the Saudi coalition. The United Nations says the Saudi-led war on Yemen has caused an estimated 233,000 deaths, including 131,000 from an indirect cause such as lack of food, health services, and infrastructure. Meanwhile, the World Food Program has estimated that around 400,000 Yemeni children under 5 are likely to die of starvation in 2021. That is nearly one child every 80 seconds. While the results of the US-sponsored Saudi aggression on Yemen speak for themselves, Washington is trying to push a narrative that the Ansarullah movement is mostly to blame for the ongoing problems in Yemen, not Saudi Arabia. After returning from a trip to some Arab states of the Persian Gulf, including Saudi Arabia, the US Special Envoy for Yemen, Tim Lenderking, accused Ansarullah of refusing a proposed ceasefire. However, the movement has consistently participated in peace talks with the Saudis and allies of former Saudi-backed government. The main reason for the failure of previous peace talks was that the Saudis refused any deal involving power sharing or a fresh election. That's why the Saudi-enforced war on Yemen was aimed at bringing the Saudi-backed former regime to power and crush the popular Ansarullah movement. Despite years of ongoing aggression against Yemenis and spending billions of dollars, Saudi Arabia and its supporter, the U.S., have been unable to defeat the popular Ansarullah movement, and the recent willingness to negotiate a truce proves their weakened position.
The U.S. Narrative should be ignored because it has nothing to do with reality or truth. The people of Yemen continue to suffer because of U.S. actions, because of U.S. sending weapons to Saudi Arabia. The Ansarullah movement has nothing to do with, they're defending the people of Yemen, certainly, but they are not the reason for the war. It is Saudi aggression financed by the United States that is the reason for the war.
The United States blames the Ansarullah movement for lack of progress in the Yemen peace process, but the administration of President Biden refuses to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade on Yemen and to stop the deadly air raids. Also, the U.S. is keeping servicing Saudi warplanes for so-called defensive purposes, despite a February announcement of halting support for bombings in Yemen.
The U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen has accused Yemen's Ansarullah movement of not trying to reach an urgently needed ceasefire in the war-torn country. That's why the Biden administration has refused to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade on Yemen, which is a key Ansarullah condition for a ceasefire. The Saudi-enforced blockade has caused a lack of food and medicine. Meanwhile, the Ansarullah movement, as well as activists and international aid groups, have been calling on Riyadh to separate the blockade from the negotiations and not use the suffering of ordinary Yemenis as a bargaining chip. Moreover, the U.S. administration of Joe Biden has tried to show itself as a so-called impartial mediator, trying to resolve the ongoing conflict in Yemen. For instance, in February, the Biden administration announced that the United States was ending its support for the Saudi-led bombing campaign in Yemen. But Biden said Washington will continue to help Saudi Arabia defend its sovereignty and land. Washington's so-called defensive support for Riyadh includes providing maintenance services to Saudi Arabia's warplanes that are bombing Yemen.
When Joe Biden became president, he made some statements about no longer financing the war in Yemen, no longer supporting it, but he continues to send arms to Saudi Arabia. Now, he calls these defensive, but that's not what they're used for. As long as the profits continue to flow to the United States, the government doesn't care who's dying. The U.S. government doesn't care whose blood is flowing, whose children are suffering and dying, as long as the profits continue to accrue to the United States. So that's what's happening now. Biden can say that he doesn't support the war anymore, but continues to send armaments that are being used in that war. So it's complete hypocrisy, which is typical for the United States. It's an ongoing, unfortunate tradition with the United States, and it's not going to stop under Joe Biden.
Washington previously announced it is halting its support for offensive Saudi-led operations in Yemen, but the U.S. is still helping Saudis in the Yemen war. Furthermore, Washington has refrained from holding Saudi Arabia accountable for the current crisis in Yemen, as it has refused to pressure Riyadh into lifting the blockade on Yemen or to end its aggression. And that is a clear sign of the U.S. shielding of Saudi Arabia and Washington's contribution to this war.
Moving on with the rest of this broadcast, U.S. President Joe Biden has accused Russia of posing challenges to Europe's security, saying that Washington will extend with its European allies against Moscow. Biden also underlined that the U.S. will not hesitate to respond to what he called Moscow's future harmful activities. The U.S. president made a comment as he is set to meet with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, later this month. Biden has ramped up pressure on Russia since taking office in January. In March, he likened Putin to a killer, which drew fierce criticism from Russia. The two countries are at odds over a range of issues. They include the Ukraine crisis and claims of the Kremlin's interference in the U.S. presidential election. That's it for this news broadcast.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Risks shoot up when virus particles accumulate in buildings, but it's not clear how best to improve ventilation, says Diane Lewis, author, in an article published under the heading Why Indoor Spaces Are Still Prime COVID Hotspots. Stay tuned for more. When Lydia Morozka leaves home, she takes with her a slick shoe-sized device that provides some sobering insights about the restaurants and offices she visits. Outside these buildings, her carbon dioxide monitor reads just above 400 parts per million, but indoors is a different story. Even in a seemingly spacious, high-ceilinged restaurant, the number sometimes shoots up as high as 2,000 ppm, a sign that the room has poor ventilation and could pose a risk for COVID-19 infection. Visual cues can be deceptive, even for Morozka, an aerosol scientist from Queensland University of Technology in Brisbane, Australia. The general public has no idea about this, she says. The situation is no different inside cafes or kindergartens around much of the world, according to researchers who have wielded similar handheld CO2 meters. And that's bad news for hopes of defeating the coronavirus SARS-CoV-2. For months, health authorities have singled out indoor spaces with poor ventilation as potential infection hotspots. And on March 1st, the World Health Organization, WHO, released a long-awaited roadmap to better ventilation. The document, which Morosco contributed to, sets out specific targets and measures that businesses and other places can take to improve ventilation and make buildings safer. But Philomera Blusin, a building engineer at the Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands, says that more needs to be done. The WHO guidelines, she says, are the minimum. Blusin and others are critical of government's failure to provide clear guidance or money for people to make indoor spaces safer. Some scientists say that has been large swathes of the population, from school children to office workers, restaurant goers, and prisoners at risk of catching COVID-19. Others say that there is no easy fix, and the precise ventilation or air purification regimes to make indoor spaces safe are not known. The complexity is not at a level that you can, with a simple set of advice, resolve it, says Ehsan Mousavi, a construction engineer at Clemson University in South Carolina, who studies indoor air quality and ventilation in hospitals. Still, many experts say that enough is known for authorities to provide clear message about how important good ventilation is for safety indoors, especially in spaces that are continuously occupied or where masks are removed when eating. On March 28, 2020, 2 months after the WHO had declared COVID-19 a global health emergency, the agency broadcast a public health message on Twitter and Facebook. Fact: COVID-19 is not airborne, it said, labeling claims to the contrary as misinformation. But evidence quickly established that the virus is transmitted by air, and researchers roundly criticized the agency. WHO updated its advice on SARS-CoV-2 transmission 3 months later, acknowledging the possibility that airborne transmission might occur in some community settings. Airborne transmission in crowded and inadequately ventilated spaces over a prolonged period of time with infected persons cannot be ruled out, the updated advice says. Yuku Lee, a building environment engineer at the University of Hong Kong, says that he is disappointed it took the WHO and other health authorities so long. We would have saved a lot of people if airborne transmission was recognized earlier, he says. A WHO spokesperson says the agency has mentioned the importance of ventilation since early in the pandemic. Others say that the WHO's position still doesn't go far enough. Airborne transmission is dominant, says environmental epidemiologist Joseph Allen at Harvard University's T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Boston, Massachusetts. That's why building controls such as ventilation and air filtration makes sense, he says. The WHO and other health authorities have failed to clearly prioritize measures to improve indoor air quality to reduce the chance of catching COVID-19, says Jose Luis Jimenez, an atmospheric chemist at the University of Colorado at Boulder. They don't emphasize how important it is, he says. What the WHO needs to say is, fact, it goes through the air, says Jimenez. We breathe it in. A stark message from the WHO would ensure that national health authorities take notice, says Jimenez. Australia, the Netherlands, and some other nations still do not acknowledge in their public statement that airborne transmission has a significant role in spreading the SARS-CoV virus. By the start of this year, concerns over ventilation had reached the boiling point. Hundreds of healthcare workers, scientists, engineers, and occupational health and safety experts signed open letters calling on government officials in Canada, the United States, Australia, Colombia, and the UK to address, among other things, poor indoor air quality. These concerted campaigns all urged local or national governments to take steps to reduce airborne transmission of SARS-CoV-2. One of the problems is that governments and businesses are still spending millions of dollars on surface disinfection, says Jimenez, despite evidence that it is rare for SARS-CoV-2 to pass from one person to another through contaminated surfaces. By contrast, few countries have invested in measures to improve indoor air quality. If we took half the efforts that's being given to disinfection and we put it on ventilation, that will be huge, Jimenez says. In October, Germany set aside 500 million euros to improve ventilation in public buildings, including schools, museums, and public offices. Businesses in Germany and South Korea can also apply for government funding to purchase mobile air purifiers that remove virus-laden aerosols. In the United States, by contrast, federal funding to improve indoor air quality was limited to healthcare providers such as hospitals until the American Rescue Plan Act, which also provides funding for schools, became law on March 11th. What makes indoor spaces so dangerous is that the virus can accumulate and infect people who do not have direct contact with an infected person. A prime example happened a year ago in Vietnam. 12 people became infected at a restaurant, but only 4 had close contact with the infected person. More recent outbreaks at gyms in Chicago, Illinois, and Hawaii have also occurred despite physical distancing of the attendees and capacity limits on fitness classes. Ever since the WHO acknowledged last year that airborne transmission could happen, public health agencies have emphasized the risk in crowded and poorly ventilated spaces. But the terminology is deceptive, says Morosco. You imagine a busy restaurant, she says. In reality, any place can become crowded and poorly ventilated, and people don't realize this. Her own modestly sized office at the Queensland University of Technology quickly becomes poorly ventilated if someone visits and the door is closed, she says. And spacious, uncrowded restaurants can appear to be well ventilated when they are not. It's one of the reasons that Jimenez and others advocate the use of inexpensive CO2 monitors as a rough measure of whether ventilation is adequate or not. As virus-carrying aerosols are exhaled, so too is CO2. And when ventilation is poor, CO2 accumulates along with the virus, says Jimenez. In an unreviewed analysis, Jimenez and his co-author Zhi Peng found that SARS-CoV-2 infection risk rises along with CO2 concentrations indoors.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Welcome back to Aperture. The illegal recycling of electronics is a toxic business on a global scale. Every year, 3/4 of electronic waste from Europe and the U.S. disappears from official recycling system and is shipped illegally to India, China, or Africa. In the first part of the documentary, we took you on an investigative journey through Africa, China, Europe, and the U.S. in an effort to unravel the out-of-control corrupt systems enabling illegal e-waste recycling. Stay with us as we further investigate to reveal the apparatus of large-scale trafficking as well as a complex chain of responsibility and collusion in the next part of the program.
The U.S. is the only country in the world, apart from Haiti, that has not ratified the Basel Convention, the international agreement banning the export of toxic waste. To make matters worse, the U.S. government itself is as bad as anyone else when it comes to recycling its own discarded equipment.
The U.S. government is the single biggest producer of electronic waste on the planet.
Discarded electronics of whole departments are routinely put out to public auction instead of being sent to trustworthy recyclers.
Whoever gives the government the best rate, in other words, they can take it for free or almost for free, the government is kind of obliged to do that because in our laws you're supposed to go the cheapest way to save the taxpayer money. But the cheapest way is the dirtiest way.
Recyclers who do actually recycle find themselves the target of shady exporters. Plant manager Craig Lorch has been in the business for more than 20 years.
We get regular requests from brokers that are in other countries looking to buy materials, buying computers, metals, laptops, anything with valuable materials in them. We don't sell to them. We don't know what they're going to do with the materials. We don't know where it's going to go.
Craig is part of a minority of conscientious recyclers who collaborate with Jim Puckett and the Basel Action Network. But many U.S. recyclers do export. The Basel Action Network estimates that between 20 and 50 e-waste containers leave U.S. harbors every day. To find out where exactly U.S. e-waste is exported to, Jim came up with a very effective spying technique.
We will just go around to these people calling themselves recyclers, and you drive by them, and the beauty is that you can't hide a big old 40-foot container. So it's very easy to photograph them, and they have prominent numbers, and we take pictures of those, and we date them.
Jim then goes online to find out where the e-waste containers are headed.
I can type that number into a database called TrackTrace. And here we see the whole record of that particular container in its last week's voyages. It's gone from Thailand to Singapore, now it's in New Zealand.
Analyzing the main trading routes for U.S. e-waste, Jim made a surprising discovery.
It comes through Hong Kong almost 65% of the time from the U.S. We didn't know that till we started tracking and tracking and tracking. Wow, they're all going to Hong Kong.
Hong Kong Harbor is the third largest port in the world, and any e-waste sent by the U.S. to Asia enters through here. But why isn't it seized and returned straight to sender? ...63,000 containers arrive here every single day on merchant ships of all shapes and sizes. Vincent Wong oversees the customs team at the harbor. The biggest terminal, Kwai Sing, receives nearly 50,000 containers a day. Up to 100 of them are estimated to contain e-waste. Tracking them down is a challenge.
Hong Kong is a free port. That means that the ship and the cargo don't have to declare to customs at the point of entry right away, except they are demanded by customs officers. They only need to declare after 14 days, within 14 days of the import or export of a consignment.
This means that by the time Wong and his colleagues receive the customs declaration, the cargo has usually long moved on. To combat this loophole, the customs inspectors pull out any containers which ring an alarm bell. For instance, because of the company's history or a tip-off from abroad, and submit them to an X-ray scan.
We can scan a container truck in less than 2 minutes, the whole truck, and then if necessary, we'll open the container for further inspection.
E-waste has its very own shape and look under an X-ray scanner. Items like computer monitors stand out clearly.
For e-waste, we have quite a number of cases in the past few years, and most of them are declared as plastic scrap or metal scrap.
Up to 36,000 e-waste containers are estimated to enter through Hong Kong Harbor every year, enough to fill 20 of the largest cargo ships. About 40 containers a year are intercepted, sent back, and their owners prosecuted.
We do not process each and every container coming or going out of Hong Kong. Around the world, there's no one custom administration that can process 100% of them.
As a result, there are always containers that escape the authorities. Chinese activists are trying to find out what happens to them.
I always want to do something to make some change. So I joined Greenpeace since 2002. The first campaign is working on the e-waste.
Lai Yun is investigating how the e-waste containers slipping through the controls at Hong Kong get to mainland China. Just north of Hong Kong Island in the New Territories, there is a perfect hiding place for e-waste in transit. Lai Yun has come to pick up the trail.
I heard about a lot of e-waste from the overseas, like the United States, coming to Hong Kong.
He soon finds a storage yard. The e-waste shipments await transport over the border. And since the storage of e-waste is not illegal, the authorities are turning a blind eye. There are dozens of yards in this area. The site contains everything from TV sets to monitors and computers. If these, as usually claimed on customs declarations, were really exported as usable second-hand goods, they wouldn't be sitting out in the open air in the rain.
I think that China and the United States so important work together to solve the e-waste problem. This is an international issue.
From the storage yards, the e-waste is smuggled across the border into mainland China. It's just a few miles away, but it's illegal.
The trucks reload in new territories and drive across very close, and they have to pay a bribe. It's the only way they could get across. Or you use a small coaster boat and go up the Pearl River Delta into areas like Nanhai. And there, again, you'd pay a bribe to unload it.
Once the e-waste has crossed the border, it travels to places like the town of Guiyu.
When we went to the Guiyu, we don't see any signs to say, okay, this is Guiyu. But we just smell, very strong, the smell. Okay, we know we arrived at Guiyu.
Guiyu is one of many Chinese towns and villages where illegal e-waste recycling is happening on an industrial scale. No. 80% of the population are involved, processing millions of tons of e-waste a year with the connivance of the industrialized nations. The owners of the yards buy the waste abroad for peanuts, then recycle it using cheap labor. No money is spent treating the toxic leftovers or protecting the workers, so an item can be recycled for a tenth of the cost charged in Europe or the US. As opposed to the African dump sites, in Guiyu, there is a division of labor.
Very typical local family workshop. The workers also recycle the plastic or CRT. This guy used the light to burn the plastic and classify different types.
Separating different kinds of plastic by burning and smelling them is a cheap and effective technique, but it damages the lungs. Another family workshop specializes in recovering minute amounts of gold by dipping motherboards into acid baths. The workers are risking cancer by breathing in the toxic smoke. Afterwards, the remaining acid is simply dumped in the river. The groundwater has also been polluted, and even a simple cup of tea is laced with toxins. The constant exposure to substances such as PCBs, lead, and mercury is causing numerous health problems, including nerve and brain damage, skin diseases, and a rise in birth defects.
Really, what's happening is people are externalizing costs. You don't want to solve the problem, you'd rather let someone else deal with it, and you'll never have to pay for it. You don't ever get a bill from China saying, you contaminated my land, you have to pay.
China's factories in the neighboring provinces, for instance in Shanghai, Yangzhou, and Guangdong, immediately buy up any recycled materials, such as copper, aluminium, iron, gold, and plastics. But e-waste recycling is not only about selling scrap materials. An even more lucrative business is the recycling of computer chips. In clandestine workshops, transistors, integrated circuits, and other components are taken off discarded motherboards. The harvested parts are sorted and cleaned and sold as brand new components for the production of new electronics. This trade is said to be worth 100 billion euros a year, but it carries a huge risk that has an impact all over the globe, wherever computer chips are a part of our lives. For instance, in trains, planes, cars, nuclear power plants, hospitals, in short, everywhere. The companies who build the control systems for this kind of equipment are finding it increasingly difficult to distinguish between new chips and refurbished ones, and to be sure that their products on which many lives depend are safe. For TQ Systems in Germany, this is a daily challenge. Since the original label has been painted over, it's hard to know which type of chip it really is. Clues pointing to the origin of the chip on the scrap heap are broken and missing pins, or labeling that has been scratched off with a crude and blunt instrument. If the chips were sold as new, they should have come from a factory like this facility in Dresden, where new chips are produced in a highly controlled environment. but the scratched surfaces point to a different origin. Guayu, or another e-waste recycling village somewhere in the developing world, and this means that the chips might be damaged. Major chip manufacturers have started to employ investigators to keep tabs on the situation.
We're currently investigating a case where a customer had purchased from the open market a power module. They introduced them into a public transportation system, and after 1 month of usage, they exploded.
The module had burnt out inside. Stephen Jetta and his team found out that it had been fraudulently relabeled with a higher temperature resistance, probably because a high resistance fetches a better price.
You can imagine if you have a power module that's originally developed in an environment where maximum voltage is 1200 voltage, and it's been remarked in 2400 voltage, it's not going to last.
TQ Systems have decided to check every single batch of chips on arrival using a special X-ray system. Take time and effort to find out if the skewed connection is harmless or likely to cause a malfunction. Mike is back in Ghana and observing a steady stream of containers arriving from all over the world. Why do the Ghanaian authorities not seize the e-waste on arrival and only let in the functional second-hand goods? A young Ghanaian investigator, Anas Arameyo, has some answers. Anas always works undercover and has never shown his face in public. He recently took his hidden camera to Tema Harbor, Ghana's main port.
E-waste was one of the biggest areas that we looked into. For example, most fraud happened through the e-waste system. Customs have a form of valuation for such home appliances or goods, and the valuation is next to nothing. Somebody goes to clear used goods from the West, and they will look at it as condemned goods, so you're not going to pay the value that you would pay it ordinarily.
At Tema Harbor, no one is really interested in separating working goods from waste. Everything is declared as waste and let in virtually tax-free, with the help of a bribe, or a little present for the customs officers.
Many of my footage, you see the SEPs officers walking through the e-waste. First of all, they themselves start picking some that they think is useful.
Then the importers sell the material. The working items go to the second-hand market, the rest to the scrap dealers. For the buyers, it's a gamble, as up to 90% can be broken or in need of repairs.
There was nothing like anybody's going to check the efficacy. In fact, at the sales point, you are told that this is it. It may have a fault or not. For example, if you take about 30 of them, the ones that will be working well will be about 2 or 3. But then the people who buy also rely on doing some repair work on it.
The items that work or can be repaired go on sale in the streets of Accra.
Majority of Ghanaians, about 90% of Ghanaians, would want to depend on the second-hand equipment. So there are new phones, there are new laptops, but it is still expensive and people don't have the money to afford these things.
The second-hand market is thriving. A functional 10-year-old computer siphoned off the recycling system in Europe or the US trades for 25 euros upwards. But there is a big problem with imported second-hand equipment. Often it has only a very short lifespan left.
We should control not only the waste, but the near end of life equipment, so things that become waste really quickly.
Ghana doesn't have any recycling facilities, so any equipment coming into the country, be it e-waste to be scrapped, new electronics, or second-hand imports, sooner or later ends up on a dump site. Ironically, many of the old appliances will have been officially charged to the recycling system in Europe before being exported. But the ones doing the actual recycling work are a group of kids who eke out a living selling the small amounts of metal they can recover. This can hardly be called efficient recycling. All this raises a seemingly naive question. Given that when we buy a new computer in Europe, its recycling is included in the purchase price, shouldn't this money end up with the person doing the actual recycling, wherever they may be on the planet? If European e-waste continues to go abroad, shouldn't the European recycling system be extended and used to set up modern recycling plants in places like Ghana? Or what about a totally different approach? While harbor controls failed to prevent the e-waste from entering, while broken electronics are traded freely on the internet, while e-waste travels the seas by the container load, while Europe and the US won't stop the ships from leaving, while recycling facilities in Europe are leaking like sieves to shady brokers, we need to remember who is at the start of the e-waste chain. The consumer. Few of us can resist the latest gadgets, and we have got into the habit of constantly replacing them with the latest model after a very short time. Last year, worldwide, nearly 50 million flat panel TV sets were sold. 300 million PCs. And 2 billion mobiles and smartphones. Sales figures for consumer electronics are constantly on the rise, and not only in Europe, but also in emerging markets such as India, China, and Africa. Maybe it's time to redefine our roles as consumers and start using our gadgets for a longer time before the entire planet is littered with discarded appliances that have a long and toxic life ahead of them as e-waste.
Perhaps it's important for the consumers to be aware of how overconsumption and subsequent illegal dumping causes suffering to other human beings across the globe. Perhaps this will lead to more responsible choices, but the bottom line is that governments in the EU and the US must take full responsibility by putting better regulations and systems in place. This toxic tide plaguing the world cannot be stopped while so many governments in the developed world are willing to turn a blind eye. And that's it for this week. Do join me again next time here on Aperture. Goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.